Good afternoon, everyone. Today is Saturday, April 13th, 2019. It is 12 p.m., and this is panel number 5303, entitled Swipe Right for a Meaningful Relationship. As a reminder, just please silence or turn off your cell phones as respect to the panelists. In this CWA session, we will utilize both the CWA app and a note card system to receive questions from the audience. To ask questions in this app, simply select the session in the schedule, tap question and answer, and then insert and send your question. You may also raise your hand to request a note card and pencil from one of our producers. You must write legibly. If you're a student, please note this in your question and make your questions brief and to the point. Now to introduce our three panelists. Starting with Lux Alptron. She is a writer whose smart commentary on sex, feminism, and pop culture has been featured in outlets including the New York Times, Cosmopolitan, Hustler, and is a columnist for 1-0. She previously served as the editor, publisher, and CEO for Fleshbot, the web's foremost blog about sexuality and adult entertainment. A sex educator at an adolescent pregnancy prevention program, and an HIV pretest counselor. Her debut book, Faking It, The Lies Women Tell About Sex and the Truths They Reveal, was released last year. Now we'll move on to...
Thank you for being so enthusiastic.
Now we'll move on to Kimberly Y. Moore. She is the CEO and co-founder of GoTogether, Inc., is an entrepreneur completely passionate about making an impact in the tech space by doing well and doing good. GoTogether delivers new, innovative transportation options for people to get where they need to go through their trusted networks. Carpool to School, GoTogether's first product in the market, is in 48 schools across the country. Moore is passionate about something else. Intentional personal transformation, hers and that of the young woman she surrounds herself with. As a woman and a leader, self-awareness is everything to Moore. Tai Toshiro is an author and speaker and social scientist. He is the author of Awkward, The Science of Why We're Socially Awkward and Why That's Awesome. His first book about the science of choosing a great long-term mate was titled The Science of Happily Ever After. He's been featured in the New York Times, The Atlantic, Time, NPR, and Sirius XM Stars. He received his PhD in psychology from the University of Minnesota and has been an award-winning professor at the University of Maryland and the University of Colorado. He is currently working on his third book. Now I invite the panelists to share their opening remarks.
Hi. So first off, I just have to plug this. My book is available for sale at Mackie. If you don't buy it today, you can also buy it online. It is a paperback. It is an ebook. It is even an audiobook read by me. So please buy my book. on the actual topic, I have been involved in online dating since 2000. The first site I ever met someone through was called Spark Match, which I'm guessing no one has heard of, but it was functionally the precursor to OkCupid. And the line that I have always really liked about online dating came from a banner ad for Nerve Personals, and it was, "Bars are for drinking." The thing that I've always just really, really loved about online dating is that while there is awkwardness or uncertainty around, you know, joining a club to potentially meet people to date, or going to a bar again to potentially meet people to date, or meeting people to date at work, like, you don't actually necessarily know if that person is single, you don't know if they're interested in a relationship. There's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of potential for uncomfortable situations where maybe you approach someone and they're not interested in dating at all, or they feel like it was very inappropriate of you. But online, through the apps, through their websites, everyone is at least flagging that they are interested in a relationship. Maybe not with you. Maybe they don't want to meet you at all. But at least there's nothing wrong. You know there's nothing wrong with approaching someone, because they have said, they've established, I'm in this space. Look, we can see if we are both potentially interested. And certainly on the double opt-in apps that we have, like Tinder and Bumble and all that, you don't even get to talk to them until you've both expressed at least a moderate amount of interest. So that's one of the reasons I love online dating, why I think it's fantastic. I mean, one of the things, in this post-Me Too era, there was a lot of discussion around, well, like, if you can't hit on someone at work, how will you meet anyone ever? Like, nobody's going to date. And it was really funny to me because, of course, we have these entire, this entire sector of technology that's entirely devoted to giving people a place to meet someone in a socially sanctioned way. It gives people a place to flirt that is appropriate because it's a space dedicated for flirting. I think that a lot of times when we have discussions about online dating, however, it comes with a lot of fear-mongering. I don't know how many of you remember a few years ago, there was a Vanity Fair piece that was like Tinder and the dating apocalypse. And the philosophy behind this was like, well, now that everybody can just go online and see all the single people, nobody's going to want to commit. Like, they're just going to constantly be shopping around because there's so many options. And number one, like, even before online dating, there were a lot of single people that you could date. That was part of why, you know, people would cheat on each other and break up. There was always other options. But secondly, I feel like if you think that online dating makes people want to perpetually online date, you have not been dating online long enough, because there is a certain amount of fatigue that sets in. In fact, many people go on something like Tinder and Bumble and find it depressing because it's like, oh, I don't like anyone. I just think this idea that access to the internet is turning us all into like horny monsters who are bad partners is not true. I mean, if somebody is like, I don't want to settle down because look, I look on Tinder and there's so many hot people, that person did not want to settle down before. So yeah, on that note, I mean, I think the internet and online dating and all this tech, a lot of times we panic about anything new, and we have absolutely seen that with online dating. And even as we got accustomed to online dating, the idea of Tinder apps and like online dating, but it's on your phone, was suddenly a new thing, and so there was panic around it. But really, these are just a conduit to other people. They come with, of course, there are downsides, but there's also benefits. And at the end of the day, the benefits and the problems that we come to or discover with online dating are often just benefits and problems that are in us and our attitudes towards dating and relationship, even without online dating.
That is such a great segue. So I come at this as a practitioner of I call it online meeting, because the dating part really hasn't happened. I'm currently on 5 dating apps. I showed him, Ty, just a second ago that I got a message from somebody on Tinder. I was riding to some panel yesterday, and you know, I'm doing texting, and another message came up from this other guy, and I was laughing, and the young lady who was, what are you laughing about? So I told her I got this crazy message from a guy. So I come at this as a practitioner and someone who's over the age of 50, where you know it's really awkward and complicated and all kinds of different things. But I really come at this from my own personal passion around transformation, that any experience is as good as you make it to be. And there's a lot of people who desire to be in love and just haven't really, really fleshed out what that means, right? So love is across so many different kinds of relationships, and I'll just speak for a lot of women I know, certainly not the women in this room, but the women that I know get so zeroed in on love relationships with a partner, as this is going to be my only place of fulfillment and actualization of me becoming a woman. And it just is not true, right? That love is just everywhere. It belongs to all of us. We can meet and engage in very deep, intimate relationships with friends and our family. And I often say that, you know, poor guy, if you meet one of my friends who has that perspective, it's like, you know, a guy on the mound getting ready to pitch. this woman's coming with, okay, I got lots for you here, buddy. You better catch this, right? You know, and that's a lot for a man who's sitting across from you to have to encounter, right? He doesn't want all. He doesn't want to be your savior. He doesn't want to, you know, he might just want to sleep with you, right? Okay, so this could be a really unproductive moment. That's kind of the way I come in. I think there's more. We can have love and experience love, but I think there's so much more that we have to do before we even get on the app, so that once we get on the app, you know, our experiences with the people, we don't take them as personally. We can have a little fun with them, and we can use this as trying to help us transform and get the love that we say we want. And to look at ourselves and how we're interacting with people, and to really own that this process is one that I am initiating and I'm not a victim to, right? And so that's kind of where I'm going to come from during our time here.
Cool. Why don't we start with this, everybody? Think about the ideal traits you'd want in a romantic partner. So if I was a genie who could make this poof partner appear, go ahead and think to yourself privately, what would be some traits that you would want? I know I'm putting some of you in an awkward position because you're here with your partner. I'm going to ask you later if they indeed have those traits, so I apologize about that. Shouldn't be on apps anyways if you're with a partner. Okay, now let's play a little game. Let's say you had three wishes. I said, okay, you only get three. We used to play this in my class. I had this psychology class. It was the science of romantic relationships. I'd have the students do this. They'd write about 16 or 17 characteristics, which is great. You know, I'm like, you go for it. And, you know, but then I'd take some of these anonymous forms, and I would go through them. I'd say, well, let's just play this out. So let's say someone wants a man, and they want a man who's tall. And to them, that's 6 foot or taller. Okay. Now let's say we have 100 eligible bachelors randomly selected from the population, all for this one lucky person. Well, by wishing for someone 6 foot or taller, 80 of those men would walk out of the room, because only 20% of men in U.S. are 6 foot or taller. Now let's say they want someone with a college degree. Well, that's about 33%, right? 35% of the population. So now they're left with 6 2/3 of a man. And now let's say they want someone who matches on political party, which has actually been one of the sharpest trends upward in preferences in the last 2 years. That's about a chance of a 30% match. So, you know, you're down to a man and a fraction at that point. Heaven forbid you want someone who is rare, right? Someone who is atheist, or someone who is Japanese American, or whatever else it might be. Now you're left with a fraction of a man. Almost any characteristic you put into this slow thought experiment leaves you with a fraction of a person in the end. So we have to be careful, right? We have to be careful about what we wish for. We want to prioritize these things and then be really targeted about looking for the things we value the most, because we might accidentally miss out on those things. Now, we have a lot of data about what people actually do when they choose partners. And that's part of the beauty of online dating. We have a lot of data now. Because we used to just ask them what they wanted, and they'd say, I want someone with good character, you know, someone who's trustworthy. They're lying. What they want, when you look at what they actually do, they want looks and money. Okay? Looks and money. Heterosexual men, looks first, money second. Heterosexual women, money first, looks second. Lesbian women, socioeconomic status first, socioeconomic status, first, both ways, I guess. And then gay men, looks, right? Ranks as the top one. So the question then becomes, does this have a good ROI? Does it have a good return on investment? So if you choose on looks and money, does that buy you satisfaction and stability? Does it get you a happily ever after? And the answer to that is no. It's a bad investment. So looks gets you nothing. In fact, women in heterosexual relationships with an attractive male partner are actually in slightly less stable relationships. And that's because that man is attractive to other people as well. When it comes to money, it caps out a little bit past the poverty line, and you get a diminishing return at that point. So I like to say there's really no difference between a partner who makes $75,000 and a partner who makes $750,000. One of the difficulties with online dating that we accidentally fall into, if you think about the behavioral, economic, cognitive error perspective, is that when we date face-to-face, we tend to evaluate it from the framework of, is this person good for me? Is this person a good partner? When we date online, what cognitive psychologists are finding is we shift our perspective to, how does this person compare to everybody else? Which is a very different perspective. And what we do when we slip into that cognitive framework is we now get even worse at emphasizing looks and socioeconomic status as the valued characteristics, but we know that those have poor ROI. The one last thing I'll allude to here before I close up is that the second feature of a lot of online dating apps or dating sites is that they will match you, right? Match.com kind of pioneered this back in 1995, and it seemed like a really sexy, cool idea. And in fact, it's a great marketing slogan. If you ask any expert in relationship science, if that's a good way to select romantic partners, they will unequivocally tell you no. Because matching does not really matter. Now, for some characteristics it does, and we can get into that, but the kinds of things they're matching you on, those are non-predictive of relationship satisfaction and stability. And it raises the question of, well, then why would they persist doing that? Maybe we can talk about that a little bit later.
So I love so much what you brought up, Ty, and I just want to address some of them. So I absolutely agree that a lot of times one of the pitfalls of online dating is we think we know what we want, and it's often not at all. Like, I had a period where I'd be like, you know, I just want to, like, date tall men. I'm just going to, like, exclusively, like, search for tall men because it was a novelty. But I realized, like, when I would meet, like, dudes who were, like, 5'6", 5'7", in person, I was still attracted. Like, there was no problem for me with dating a shorter guy. It was just in my head, this was a thing of like, oh, that's so attractive. And I have had the experience of dating people who I knew in real life and then kind of connected to through online profiles. And their profiles, if I had not known them in person, but I'd seen their profiles, I would never have been like, that's the person for me. But, like, having known them in person, I was like, oh, that's a cool person. Like, I will go out on a date with them and end up having really fulfilling relationships that might never have started if I didn't have that extra context and extra info. So as much as I'm, like, a fan of online dating, I absolutely agree that the psychology behind it can mislead us and can fall into these traps of misjudging what's actually important.
Yeah, no, I like your comment. It's neither good nor bad, right? Yeah. It depends on how you use it. And so I don't want to give anyone the impression I say don't use online dating. No, it's a great tool for sure and creates a lot of opportunity. But then we just have to be smart about how we use this new tool. And no one's really given us a lot of manuals, right, for how to use this new thing.
And, you know, as someone who is 50 and older, online dating or apps actually become a really good resource because as you get older, your community of connecting gets smaller, right? And so the apps open the opportunity to meet more people around your age as you're getting older. So for me, that's really kind of cool. Again, I come at this a little different. You know, there's a lot of, you need to sit next to a single person on a dating app like I did with my house host the other night to really see how crazy it is, you know? You know, so I do have a very clear vision of what I'm looking for, right? And I really, you know, people, men ask, well, what are you hoping to find on this app? Well, I'm hoping to just meet someone. This is just another way to meet somebody. Like, I'm not hoping to find the love of my life, which most of them are saying, my soulmate. I don't know how you do that on an app, right? I think you have the opportunity to meet some people, but I think having a very clear vision of what you want helps you swipe right and left very quickly. Even if I'm looking for people who are able to communicate something about themselves that makes me want to swipe right. Pictures, really kind of tell the story for me. So I don't swipe right on people who take pictures in mirrors in the bathroom or, in their house, right? The mirror thing that I immediately, boom, you're to the left. I also, if I see their picture and they look like they're in their house, I'm looking in the background to see, do we have the same taste? Okay? Because if you have a certain taste, I already know it's not going to work, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm swipe left on you too on that one. But I do feel like it's one of these things that it can be very addictive. It can be exhausting. You can put so much into it. But it's just one of many spaces to be able to meet people. I personally, with a group of women, are writing a book called Journey to the One. Mm-hmm. He's closer than you think. With the idea that really practicing being open and available. So this is one of the things that we discover with my friends is that, women often are only open and available in situations. When I go to church, when I'm at work, when I'm, places that we go, I think I could meet somebody here, right? Well, the truth is we need to be open all the time. So if we are at the grocery store, we need to be open because he could be there. He could be at the gas station because rich men pump their, gas too, right? So unless he drives a Tesla, right? So you could meet him at the gas station. My little secret was, and continues to be, is I go to Nordstrom's in the men's department in my area, and they shine shoes there. Uh-huh. So I take a bag of my shoes, leather shoes that need to be shined, and I sit there and get my shoes shined. I have a legitimate reason for being in the men's department. And I'm often accompanied by men who are sitting on both sides. And I get to look around and see, And they get to see I'm not intimidated about being there, right? And at a minimum, it just opens up the dialogue to just see men as just people to engage with and just to have 1 minute of fun, But the whole idea is to be open everywhere.
So I want to go back to what you said about apps being good if you're older because your community sometimes feels smaller. I think that one thing that isn't often talked about as much as it should be is that, for a lot of people who are in smaller communities or who are in marginalized or alternative identities, especially if you're a queer person who lives in a small town, online dating can be a lifeline for you. I mean, certainly in the big city it can also be helpful, but it used to be you're a queer person, you have to go to this bar. That's how you meet people. And maybe there might be some other group activities or whatever, but it was really pretty limited, your opportunity of where you were going to go that you knew there would be other queer people. But as soon as you got online dating, you don't even have to leave your house necessarily. You can just put up who you are, what you're interested in, and other people can find you even if you're not in the same geographic area. And I think that's one of the reasons why we've seen it's much easier to be a queer person in a small town or rural area now because you can go on the internet and find a community and find partners that way. And certainly people who are in kink communities, people who have other specialized needs where you're not necessarily going to be able to see immediately when you see someone, or you might traditionally have to have gone to a special club or a special space. Now you can just more readily say hey, this is my thing. If it's your thing, let me know. And it's a lot easier to find people that way. And I think that that form of connection is really, really important.
I think that's a great point. I couldn't agree more with that, and that's been a wonderful thing. Even for awkward people, it's been a good thing.
Especially for awkward
people. Yeah, they get to meet in a way that's not as daunting. I want to go back to the Nordstrom's idea. I love this idea. I feel like you should write an article about that. That is brilliant. They did a really fancy study in the 1970s at Boston University. And their question, their research question was, what is the best predictors of interpersonal attraction? So it could be platonic or romantic or whatever, but this was a landmark study. So they got these dormitories at Boston University, and they tested everybody in the dorms. So they gave them intelligence tests, personality tests, attitudes, values, religion, whatever. So they had these huge psychological batteries on everybody. And they were really excited to run these sophisticated models to see which variables pop out as the best predictors. The most boring one possible came out as by far the strongest predictor, and it still replicates to this day. The best predictor was, in these U-shaped dormitories, the people who lived closest to the exits had the most friends at the end of the year. Which is totally boring. And why is that? It's because the most people had to pass by, right, where they were at. And we call this proximity in psychology. So the best thing you can do romantically is to establish proximity around the kind of person that you want to be around. Three other things popped out that have stayed pretty constant. Similarity of values and attitudes. Predicts attraction. Reciprocity liking, which is a jargony way to say you need to tell the person you like them. Okay? And if you do that, then they have a chance to tell you that back. But you would be shocked at how infrequently, you've probably had this with friends, right? They are madly in love with somebody and you have to give them the obvious advice. Well, you need to tell them, right, if you're going to have a shot of this thing working out. The last one is physical attractiveness. And you know, there's not much we can do about that, but the first three variables, there's a lot that you can do about that.
All right, going off of that, I would like to ask the other panelists what their suggestions are on how to do dating apps well and how to communicate most effectively to understand the people that they're talking to.
So my favorite dating app was always OkCupid, like pre the swiping thing, and I always really liked it because I loved the essays. I loved that like people really had to tell you who they were, although I was told when I would do it that I had an unfair advantage because I am a writer. And therefore was like very, very good at just crafting all of this stuff. You know, I don't know that I have some like really good like fail-safe strategy of here's how you use it, here's how you find love. I mean, I think a lot of it is just use it not as a I'm definitely going to find the person this way, but use it as a way to expose yourself to people. Just think of it as like, here's a way to connect with people I might otherwise never meet. People who maybe aren't going to like run into me at the store or at this club or wherever I go. And just go through it and kind of treat it as very low stakes. Don't get too attached to anything because so many of these things, like sometimes you fall in love with a profile and the person is not actually active anymore. Like, not, and they've quit apps. They're never going to see your message. So I'd say, you know, kind of treat it as a low-stakes thing. Think about it as like, hey, I can get an initial sense of this person, see if I like them, and then if we both are interested, we can meet up. And for me, the meeting up is when it really starts. Like, everything else is just about getting yourself in the same place at the same time with an openness towards exploring something. But this is also part of why I think this idea that like online dating is fundamentally different from other forms of meeting people is a little ridiculous, because it's like once you're in the same space, maybe there's a slightly different initial conversation, but that's when the relationship actually begins. And everything from there on out is pretty much the same no matter how you met.
Yeah, so that creating your profile is really key. So a group of women and I actually just did this about 6 months ago, and we actually helped each other do our profiles because what our friends would be writing would be like, "Why are you writing that? You know, what do you what? Why why are you writing that? So we would talk with them and have them say what they want to say about themselves, and someone else would write it. So that was really good. The other thing, I also think that we should all know that there are a lot of fake people on dating apps. People who use other people's photos, who may show up like they look like who they are. And you have to get really smart. So, because the other thing is that, you know, there's, I used to think this was something that happened with just young people where, you know, young people now, when you call them, they don't answer their phone, right? And sometimes when you text them, they take forever to text back. But you know they're like this with the phone, right? They're sleeping with it. So their choice of not to text back is communicating volumes. But on these dating apps is that, you know, you got to commit to not stay in messaging forever, right? You got to put some timeline. You got to, you know, and you need to do that in a way. And because texting, messaging doesn't have tonality and all these other things, there is an art to how you say that so the other person doesn't go, wow, they're really restrictive or whatever the case might be. But to let them know, hey, listen, you know, this is cool for now. But we got to move off of here and to begin a real relationship. And the last thing I'll say about that is, you know, even you know, as there are these fake people who are out there, is that it does help eliminate what I don't want, right? I get to that much faster on dating apps than I do. I am looking for someone who can complete a bit of a profile. Give me a little glimpse of who you are, okay? Just a little. Because sometimes, especially if you're a little older, you know, your pictures don't really reflect who you are. And sometimes you have old pictures on there that are, you can't really see the person. And it just really makes a lot of sense to, you know, give the person a little bit more of who you are.
I just want a second that I feel like meeting people in person as soon as possible is a good strategy. Like, I have always, like, as soon as I establish mutual interest, I will usually just be like, hey, why don't we meet up and get drinks or get dinner or whatever. I mean, I'd say often, like, drinks or something more low stakes than, like, a meal is usually a better idea in case the person sucks. But, like, I don't want to text a stranger. Like, that's not interesting for me. That's not fun. I will, like, maybe do a little back and forth just to establish that there's somebody who seems like someone I can talk to.
How much is a little? Like, how much?
I mean, it depends. It depends. But, like, I know people who want to spend, like, days talking, and I'm like, I don't have time for that. I have actual friends. I have people in my life that I want to talk to.
Talking on the phone or the messaging?
No, like, the messaging. I would never give out my phone number if I hadn't met the person just because... Because sometimes you meet people and they make you uncomfortable and then you don't want them to have your phone number. But yeah, for me, I mean, sometimes a girl reached out to me once and she was like, oh, I recognize you. I love your writing. And then I was like, oh, cool. Like, we should meet up. Because she was someone that I had thought was really cool. She had established interest in me. Like, everything she had listed in her profile, I was like, she's someone I think is going to be interesting. And I didn't really have to, like, go further than that because it was already kind of all there. And I was like, I'm sure at the very least having coffee with this person will be fine for me. But, like, some other people, like, it really is an individual thing. And it's also an individual comfort thing, I think. Like, you might have a totally different strategy. But I personally just, like, I don't see being online as the place to get to know someone. I see being online as the place to find someone that I can meet in person.
What do you think about that? Like, because some people are more awkward, but they probably are very cool to be with, you know,
well, maybe
face
not.
To face.
Yeah, maybe not. Who knows? Yeah. No, that's good. A good point. There's kind of that U-shaped curve, right, where some messaging is good, but it kind of peaks out pretty early, and now you have a decline, right? It gets annoying, so
yeah.
I would totally agree with that. But yeah, I would agree with both of you. The point is to get face-to-face. I like that distinction, online meeting versus online dating, right? The app is online meeting, and nothing wrong with that, right? That's fine. My friend Jess Carbino is the chief science officer at Bumble. And she says, despite all the fancy user interfaces and despite all the algorithms and everything else, the main point of this thing is to get people to have a coffee together,
yeah,
or to have a dinner together. There's no magic, you know, in this thing that's going to make something happen. They just have to get face to face. You know, there's all humans are built to understand one another through all five senses. It's actually fascinating to look at the data on how we use sense, how we use tone of voice, how we use distance, touch, and all these other cues to formulate a holistic view of a person, and how some of those things can then combine together in ways that we never would have imagined and can make us attracted to somebody. And of course, online, you lose all those opportunities. One of my favorite findings from that body of studies is they asked people who are in long-term relationships, when your partner is traveling for more than a week, do you sometimes smell their dirty laundry? Have a creepy thing to do. 60% of people smell their partner's dirty laundry. But it just tells you that, you know, here's this cue that is such a powerful emotional reminder of their attachment to this person. I think that's actually pretty neat, despite being creepy. So,
if it's consensual, it's not.
It's
creepy.
Consensual, so yes. Sniffing, I guess. But the one thing I'd say tactically as a general piece of advice regarding online dating is one of the great benefits of online dating is just the numbers,
yeah,
right? Instead of just having a handful of people, a few dozen, a few hundred, it's now gone to thousands or 10,000. Well, that's overwhelming too, right? And so what they're finding is that the best thing you can do is to actually get a little bit picky. Don't get too picky. Three wishes, remember. But get a little bit picky. The things that are important to you, go ahead and put those out there. You know, if you really, you know, it's like a competitive analysis or a market analysis in business. You want to distinguish yourself from everybody else. You want to say what your unique value add is. You know, so don't say that you love fall or pumpkin spice lattes or whatever, you know, because you think about how many other people are saying that, probably quite a few. And so what you want to do is point out kind of the weird things about you, the passionate things, you know, about you. And maybe if you want those in a partner, go ahead and put those out there. And then what happens when you put yourself out in the world like that is those other weirdos, just like you, right, are going to be unusually attracted to the fact that you put that out there.
So I actually just want to share a little bit of online dating history, like from the business side, that you just reminded me of when you talked about numbers. So one of the earlier, certainly not the earliest, but one of the earlier sites that was out there, I think it launched in 2001, was Nerve Personals. And so Nerve.com was this site that was supposed to be like smart writing about sex, and it attracted a specific sort of person. And so they were like, hey, we'll create our own personals site. So you would go to Nerve.com and then you could also create a profile. Then Nerve was like, wow, this is doing well. What if we expanded this to other sites? So they reached out to some sites that were not quite Nerve, but were like in the same sort of young, hip audience. So I'm blanking on what they were initially, but it was like Bust.com, which is a feminist magazine. They had like Bust.com personals, and they had the Onion.com personals, and like a couple of other things. And they were all, it was a white label thing, so you would go to the Onion, and you would see the Onion personals, but it was all feeding into the same database. And I think you could, when you were searching, say, I only want to see people from the Onion.com, but other than that, you would see everybody from all these sites. Then Nerve Personals was like, hey, this is going so well, we're going to create a different company. And so they created Spring Street Networks, which started just managing all of these personal sites and started adding more and more and more partners. By the way, I should mention, I know this story, A, because I was an intern at Nerve, and then B, because I was friends with the systems administrator for Spring Street Networks we'll get to that. So they start adding more and more sites. And again, it's all feeding into the same database. And suddenly, there starts to be a little bit of a problem, because when it was just Nerve.com personals, or even like Nerve.com and Bust personals, I could go on and I would say, hey, everybody who's here shares my interests. Like, everybody who's here is someone who is like young, they're kind of hip, they're interested in talking about sex, all of this stuff. And that was the whole attraction of the initial site, that you were going to a self-selecting population. But now suddenly you had Boston.com, and like, I don't even remember remember all of them, but you had like a lot of these like unrelated sites, and the population started getting really, really diluted. And on the back end, there was like the CTO kept promising he was going to come up with this algorithm that was going to filter people, because again, this was the early 2000s, so like some of the stuff we now take for granted was not happening then. But he was like, it's going to filter the matches so people will see only the people they're most likely to like, and blah, blah, blah. Except he was like apparently kind of having a breakdown and not actually doing work, but promising he was going to do it. And then he got laid off. And then in like 2004, which is like when I was hanging out with the sysadmin, the whole thing just kind of collapsed, because they had all these partners, but these partners were worthless because people either weren't really signing up, or they were signing up and they were like, we're just getting fed into this like garbage database of like every kind of person, and it's hard to find the people that I like. And Spring Street Networks ended up getting sold, and then doesn't exist anymore. But it was always just an interesting thing for me, because you want enough, it's a difficult thing, because technically you do kind of want a lot of people, so you have a lot of choices, but you also want the ability to find people that you are going to be most like. And you don't want to have to, I guess with swiping it's a little bit less bad because it's so fast, but theoretically you don't actually want to have to trawl through all of these different people who have nothing in common with you. You want to be able to see a pool of people who are at least potentially of interest. And it becomes like a complicated thing, because of course the sites just want to make money, so they want all the people. But there is, I think, yeah, this balance that has to be struck between getting a lot of people but also not totally diluting the selectivity and the chance that you will mostly be seeing people who have at least something in common with you.
All right, so what is the online modern protocol for internet dating involving when to meet up, sexting, and who picks up the check?
Oh, I have to first go on a date to figure out what that argument is. I haven't done that one yet. I think we kind of talked about, you know, the time between, you know, the initial messaging, and it's personal preference for how long you do that. But it is true, you should get to a meeting first as a way to connect with someone. I know for me, going back to the profile of putting yourself out there, one of the things that's really important to me as it relates to dating men, I want to date a man who has other male friends that they really are close to and invite to, like, hold them accountable. That's really important to me. And I'm very close to my family. Those are two big things for me. I think that, yes, he's going to pay the check. I'm sorry. That's going to happen for me. Coffee, dinner, whatever. That's just going to be my thing for me.
So I'm curious to know Emma's answer to that question, since she is the youngest of us. But, I mean, I personally would say, like, it's going to depend on who you are. Like, if you are comfortable sexting before you meet someone, then do that.
I'm not comfortable.
Yeah. If you need... and I think many of us are not. If you need to have actually had sex with someone before you sex them, that's also fine. Picking up the check, it's the same as, like, if you met someone anywhere. Like, some people prefer to split, some people don't. And I don't think there's a... For me, I don't think there's a right or wrong answer, but I think it's something that you kind of navigate the same way you would navigate if you met someone at a bar or met someone with friends. But I am really interested in our youth panelists' perspective on this.
Okay.
Sorry to put you on the spot.
No, it's fine. So I'm a busy person, and if someone doesn't want to meet up within a week, week and a half, I tend to get bored. And you can't draw out long conversations over dating apps with that long time period. It's just not realistic in the kind of student lifestyle. As for sexting, I don't do that, so I don't have a comment on that one. And as for the check, I think at least in the student perspective, we're all struggling and most likely poor, so I suggest splitting it.
Thank you for the youth perspective.
All right, so what does online dating do for the first impression, and how does this differ from the organic impressions that you meet?
For me, I think it's worse. I have worse impression, right? So I just happened to met a guy out at a business environment and had coffee with him 2 times, and I got matched with him on Bumble. I was like, oh. And I didn't want to, I mean, he was great, so here's where my bias come in. He's only like 5'8", I'm 5'7". I want somebody who's a little bit taller than I am. He's a little smaller, you know, so I had all those things. But he was a really interesting guy. So this is what your science says, is that when you put all these things kind of together, he becomes more attracted to me. But if I had just seen his profile for the first time, I'd have completely swiped left because he was 5'8", you know, he looked to be a little slight. And so that's, you know, that's not okay. So I'm much quicker to swipe left.
So, yeah, I think for me, historically, like, I've had a good sense from someone's online profile if I am going to like them, or at least like them enough to hang out once and have a like decent evening. But I do think I probably eliminate people that if I met in person, they might be like, oh, I would hang out with you for a little bit. Yeah, I think, like, as has been said before, when you meet someone in person, there's just, like, more data points. There's more stuff. But at the same time, when you meet someone online, sometimes they surface things that would have been a deal breaker eventually. Like, you might be really attracted to them, but then find out, like, there's some incompatibility that online, it's like, oh, okay, like, you definitely want kids and I definitely don't, or something like that. I think it can be useful. Even if it makes you pickier, it can be useful because sometimes it helps you avoid conversations that can be sometimes difficult or that you don't always know how to bring up.
Yeah, I don't know that it would. I think a lot of these things wash out, right? Because there's biases both ways. You meet people in person, there's certain inaccuracies that you might suffer in that situation. Online could be the same thing. I think the thing to watch out for the most probably in online dating is just the supreme power of the profile picture and the pictures in general. I agree that, you know, someone's in the bathroom in the mirror, that's probably a good criteria to swipe left on that. But if they're attractive, that's actually what concerns me a bit, because there's this bias called what is beautiful is good. It's a stereotype. And we have this tendency to imbue attractive people with all these qualities they don't have, necessarily. It's not that they're worse than anybody else. It's just that they're not as friendly and intelligent and all these other things that we ascribe to people who are more physically attractive. So you just want to correct for that a little bit. I think the other thing that goes a little awry sometimes is you can build up this fairy tale narrative in your head about who this person is before you actually get face to face. You know, so you have this whole idea about how this is going to go and play out, and that's a great recipe for disappointment. So you probably want to avoid that as well.
So, when you said picture, you reminded me of, like, one of my favorite pieces of writing about online dating came from when OkCupid was doing a really data-driven blog. I guess they still do it, but it's not written by Christian Rutter anymore, who was one of the founders of OkCupid, who also has a book about all this kind of stuff. But there was one that I just really thought was great. And it basically, the advice that they gave you based on their data was whatever you feel like is a little bit weird about you or that you feel a little insecure about, highlight that in the photo. And then the math, the statistics they used to break that down was, I'd say, okay, we have 2 women. Both of these women are in aggregate rated a 7 by their by all the people who are rating them. And one was kind of this like generically pretty blonde girl, and the other was someone who had like a lot of like dyed hair, piercings, like tattoos, more of an alternative look. Like, so they said, you know, both of these women are 7s, but there's a very different way that each of them arrives at a 7. The more like generically pretty girl, she's just across the board rated a 7. But this alternative looking girl with the piercings and the tattoos, 7 people rated her a 10 and 3 people rated her a 0. So in that case, like if you are focusing on the things that are different about you, you might have polarized opinions about how you look, but the people who like you really like you. Whereas if it's kind of like, I'm just going to crowd pleasingly like look generically pretty or whatever, you might get a lot of people being like, oh yeah, she's pretty, but you're not necessarily going to get the same like passionate response, like that person's really, really attractive. And I thought that that was really, I don't know, I just really liked how to put that, that like, you know, focus on what you like about yourself, but also like instead of trying to be as like palatable to as many people as possible, put yourself in a light to really attract people who are going to really, really like who you actually are.
That's good.
All right. What do you think about the link between hookup culture and dating apps, and do those devalue the institution of marriage or monogamy?
Yes. any guy who has in his profile that he is interested in hookups, boom, swipe left for me. It's a little creepy 50-year-old man hookup thing that really is really just... I know it exists. Like, I know it's there. I know it exists. My co-founder is over 50, and he only dates younger women. So this is a real story for him, right? But it's just like, I think that serial dating, I do think, sort of creates a culture of, you know, this need for variety. And so monogamy really gets alluded to me in that way.
So I have a somewhat different opinion. I do think that if what we're calling hookup culture or casual dating is probably more socially acceptable now than once it was. I don't think that that actually has to do with online dating. I think that has to do with changing cultural attitudes. I am of the opinion, like, I think if monogamy and marriage is what you want, that's great, and you should go after that. But I think there are a lot of people who historically have ended up in monogamous marriages, not because they wanted that, but because they were told over and over, like, this is how you be an adult. This is how you do things. This is what you're supposed to do. And that's part of why, like, once divorce became socially acceptable, we saw a lot of divorces, because people kind of shoehorned themselves into this idea of what they were supposed to be, rather than pursuing what was right for them. So, I mean, I think if people want to only casually date, and they're open about that, and they're only dating people who are okay with that, that's fine. If people want to be in non-monogamous relationships, and they're being open about that, and other people are consenting to that, that's fine. Like, I don't think, in the same way that I don't think that same-sex marriage dilutes heterosexual marriage, I don't think other people choosing to do what's right for them is necessarily harming your relationship. I can understand it being frustrating if it feels like, but I want a monogamous relationship and now nobody wants that. But forcing someone to be in a monogamous relationship that they never actually really wanted to be in is not the basis for a strong relationship. We all kind of need to find people who share our priorities and who want the same thing that we want. That's how we get stable, healthy relationships.
You know, I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. I also think that because of this cultural changes that have happened, there are more people online who say they want non-monogamous relationships. There are also married couples online, yeah, on Bumble and all those, and married men who say they are in an open relationship and, you know, want to have that. So I think that's...
I think there have indeed been these attitude shifts and a more liberal view of sexuality, and I think that's a great thing, for sure. One of the other interesting outcomes, I think, of this is that sometimes older generations will rip on millennials, although I shouldn't even say that term anymore because that's kind of becoming a bad word. But
I'm a millennial, by the way.
Yeah. That's the favorite thing, right, is to say, oh, these young people into rock and roll music and everything. And their hookup culture and whatever else. Now, here's the interesting thing about that age group is, so these are 20-somethings, 30-somethings, is that they have actually had fewer sexual partners compared to Gen X and baby boomers when you adjust for age. So there, in fact, there's what we're calling now a sex recession. It actually looks like an economic recession. And it's most concentrated among young adults and particularly young men. So the General Social Survey, which is this huge randomly sampled survey, has this question in there about how often people have had sex in the last year. 17,000 people answered this question in the last General Social Survey. And one of the questions is, I haven't had sex for the past year. And they call those the dry spell people. Mm-hmm. Now, 10 years ago, the rate of dry spell people among 20-somethings was about 13%. And the most recent poll, last year, that had risen to 19% for women, 20-somethings, and risen to 23% for men in that age group. 40-year-olds are having more sex, okay, or not experiencing as many dry spells as the 20-somethings are. And it's really remarkable. And that can be a whole discussion all by itself. So there have been these shifts in attitudes, which, like I said, I think it's wonderful. But then it's been really intriguing to me that you've then seen this decline in sex, particularly among 20-somethings.
Well, I will say, I not to get off on the whole other conversation, but just to give some of that context, just in case people are panicking hearing that about how like nobody's ever gonna have sex and we're all gonna die out. No, I mean, I think there's actually a lot of possible reasons. Like, people get married later, and proximity leads to sex. So if you're not married, you're less likely to have frequent sex. Asexuality is something that people are more comfortable communicating about and identifying as. So some people are not even necessarily asexual, but some people are just feeling more comfortable not having sex or saying, like, I don't want to have sex, or saying no to sex that they don't want, which I think is a good thing. So, I mean, I feel like a lot of people hear those numbers and panic, but, like, there are potentially upsides to it.
I wonder if that number is not associated with maybe people aren't having sex with other people, but maybe they may be addicted to pornography. Mm. Right? And I wonder what that...
So they've looked at some of the predictors of this, and that's been one, and it comes up as a significant predictor. To get to the idea that it's more okay to say no to sex you don't want, that comes out as the strongest predictor, and I think that's a good... It's kind of like heterosexual women are putting squeeze on heterosexual men, and they're saying, this needs to be better than it's been. And I actually, that's a good thing. You know, there's this, they call it the orgasm gap. And I think they're hilarious studies. So if you ask people about their last sexual encounter, and it's a heterosexual couples, and you ask the guy, so did your partner orgasm? 95% of the time, he's like, oh, yeah. Now you ask the woman, so did you actually orgasm? She's like, 63% of the time they say yes, but the rest of the time the guy thought it was something else, you know? So there has been this pleasure gap. And I really think this is interesting that 20 and 30-something women are saying this is not acceptable. This is not okay. And the one last kind of esoteric thing I'll say about this is I'm extra happy about this because in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is what we use to diagnose mental disorders, there's female sexual arousal disorder, but there's nothing called male ability to pleasure disorder.
Right? That's good.
So speaking on women's more encouraged ability to say no, what are the panel's thoughts on the Me Too movement and its effects on dating in intimate relationships?
I love the Me Too movement. I don't know if I personally think it's actually having some strong effect on dating and intimate relationships. I know online men are like, I'm too scared to ask someone out, blah, 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 blah. But I can tell you that just walking down the street, men do not seem to have changed their behavior very much. I really don't think they're that panicked about it. I mean, I think anything that raises awareness about inappropriate behavior, I think anything that forces people to look back at their history and say, wow, this thing that I thought was consensual, was it? Like, how can I be better about making sure that the people that I'm having sex with or expressing sexual interest in and all of that, like, how can I be more sure that they are comfortable with that? And also, how can I make amends if I happen to cross a line unintentionally, ideally, hopefully unintentionally. I hope nobody's intending to cross lines. I mean, I think the conversation has, in some cases, more productively than others, but I think it has just helped shine a light on this problem that, you know, a lot of men are raised to just sort of see women as objects to be pursued, not people to mutually form a consensual relationship with.
Yeah, I don't know that I've really made any correlation to how it's affected dating at all.
I think it's interesting as a guy, you know, who wants to do the right thing. I would say for me, it has certainly sparked a considerable amount of thought about, if you were at the comedy thing yesterday, I'm having a hard time making out these days, partly because of indecision about what's the right and proper thing to do. And it can get a bit confusing, and I think I would say it's better to err on the side of deliberation and of judiciousness. And I think it's worthwhile for us to go through this period of maybe some ambiguity sometimes to figure out exactly what everybody wants.
Yeah, I mean, it's better to miss out on sex that you want than have sex that one person doesn't want, I would say. Like, it's funny, this is slight tangent, but like one of the things that would always come up when I would talk about these things, even before Me Too, is I would say, you know, about how like men would maybe push my boundaries or would do things that made me uncomfortable, and they would be like, oh, but you know, sometimes you have to do that because some girls won't tell you what they want, and like some girls like want to be pushed like that. And I'm like, yeah, here's the thing. Women who cannot speak up about what they want and need you to like push them and like potentially violate their boundaries, they need to learn to ask for what they want. You shouldn't be punishing everybody else by assuming that I can't speak up about what I want and assuming that I need to be pushed or pressured or that my no is actually a maybe. And I think that, like, you know, the conversations we have are getting us to that place, getting us to a place where it's like, yeah, people need to learn to ask for what they want, and if you don't, the punishment should be you don't get to have sex. It shouldn't be I can speak up about what I want and I get unwanted sex because it's assumed that I can't speak up.
Okay. Given that race, sexual orientation, and preference and other factors are present on dating sites, what do we need to be aware of when on the sites?
I'm not sure I understand.
I think part of the problem with some of those variables is that the machine learning and artificial intelligence they're using to run some of the analyses and create some of the algorithms, they become very racist, actually, all on their own. You probably read about this in the headlines. With machine learning and with AI, you have to have human involvement. You have to have human involvement to seed the algorithms with the right decisions in the first place, because there will inevitably be certain unconscious behaviors that lead that algorithm down a path that I think, in my opinion, doesn't leave the overall group in a good place. So that's my biggest concern with that. It's actually not the humans in this case. It's actually the machines.
But also the humans who are informing the machines, too, I think. Definitely. I think racism in online dating is a huge problem, just for all the reasons that Ty brought up, that, like, you will see, the OkCupid blog had something about how, I think, like, lowest response rates were to Asian men and black women, just because of bias and racism and all of that. And I think that's really unfortunate. I think we need to be cognizant of the fact that we bring our biases with us online, that there's this whole fictional idea that, like, on the internet, everybody's equal. But it's not true, and it's really, really unfortunate. And that is something that we really, I think, all internally need to look at, like, what biases we are bringing when we go online.
So, as a woman of color, I'm actually very open to dating men who are not African American. And so on some of the profiles, I mean, as part of the filter, you select the person ethnicity that you are willing to. So I make some assumptions that I actually get matched with more Caucasian men than African American men. And when I do so, we start having a little chatter. And I do get to a point where I ask the question, have you ever dated any women of color before? And I'm not just talking about African American, Hispanic, whatever. And because I want to know, like, I'm actually not interested in being an experiment. I really am not. Like, I want a relationship, which means that I want to meet your friends and I want to meet your family, your coworkers. And so navigating that can be a little bit, you know, awkward, especially if it's not a phone conversation and it's early and I'm, you know, messaging back and forth. But that's important to me. I appreciate, you know, if you had it in your profile that you were open to women of color, African Americans specifically, but to really be willing to engage in that conversation about what does that mean. And one guy, he was oblivious to, like, well, why would it be any different? Okay, all right. Let's just talk about food, right? When you come to my house, there, and we have a family gathering, there's a certain kind of food you're going to have, right? And, you know, are you going to be okay? Now, because we are a minority in the culture, we're more accustomed to being around white people than you are in a close environment to being around black people. So I am trying to look for people who are culturally competent, right? I look for men who have other ethnicities as friends in their pictures. So that, you know, it's not really like this thing I'm going to do. I'm going to go on a date with you. That's great. But I'm looking for a relationship, and I'm looking for someone who's paying attention. If I make that as my choice to date someone who is not like me, then I am also saying I'm going to get connected to a culture that maybe I haven't been up close and personal to, and that I'm really open to that.
All right, we've gone from long profiles and compatibility assessments to short profiles and swiping. What comes next for online dating, and is there a better way?
I mean, I think, like, better way is about the individual. Like I said, I loved the era of longer profiles and, like, getting to know people, but a lot of those sites have been abandoned, so it doesn't, they don't work as well because of that. The thing that was always funny to me was that Tinder and the swiping thing, the reason they went with that interface was because they were like, oh, this mimics what it's like to meet someone at a bar, because you just get that, like, quick first impression, and then you decide you want to talk to them. I hate meeting people at bars. So it was always very frustrating to me, because I was like, no, but the whole point of online dating was that I had some context, and I could go in and be like, hey, I kind of like you, and now that's been taken away from me. Yeah, I mean, I don't know that I can say what comes next, and I don't really think that any of them are necessarily better. It's just about what your individual preference is and what kind of style and what kind of information you want to have before you connect with someone.
I got no opinion on that.
Mm-hmm. I have no idea what's next. So. Yeah.
All right. Can anyone speak to online dating specific to the sugar daddy websites?
I'm not 100% sure what is being asked there. I can say that is a form of sex work. And it's, which I say with no judgment, I'm very in favor of sex work and sex workers' rights. It's a form of sex work. It's people who are looking for clients who are going to have a specific kind of arrangement with them, and people who are looking to pay for sex. It's a transactional relationship more so than, a lot of dating is transactional, but this is, like, explicitly and much more so. But I'm not, I mean, is someone wanting to be a sugar baby or a sugar daddy? I cannot give you advice there. I'm sorry.
So I actually know someone who's on that, mm-hmm. a guy who, you know, doesn't desire to be, he's very successful, doesn't desire to be married, and likes dating younger women, and he loves it. He gets to meet, he meets a lot of really smart, attractive, I've met a few of them, But he loves it. I mean, he feels like it communicates clarity on what he wants, right? And it works for him. Yeah.
All right, with that, do you guys have any ending comments?
I think if you are considering online dating and you have some hesitation, just jump into it. It's very low risk. If you don't like anybody that you see, you can delete the app. I mean, the ones now, they're not that much work. Some people just put up like a picture. Like, it's a lot of work to swipe, I guess. It can be a time suck, but then you decide you don't like it.
I mean, you know, people spend that kind of time on Twitter or Instagram, so it is a lot. My last comments would be, more than on getting on the dating apps, I would say to take a step back and say, what do I really want, right? And to really get informed about what do I really want, what does love really look like to me, can I practice being open and available to people who are in my space, wherever that space is. And I think, and I'm speaking about my conversations with, you know, friends of mine, is that, you know, for many women who, you know, the dating app becomes a good way of saying there's no men out there, mm-hmm. I really challenge that and to say, you know what, dating is a vulnerable experience, right? And are you avoiding being vulnerable and really sort of pulling off the layers of that? Because love is risky. And so if your ultimate goal is to be in love and be in a relationship, then dating is only the pathway of testing my ability to be vulnerable so I can be in love. And that's what I would say.
You know, I think one of the things that strikes me is just how much dating has changed over the last 10 years. It has been so dramatic and abrupt that if you feel confused, I don't blame you. You know, it's very different out there. It's very fast changing, and as those kinds of revolutions happen, in this case, it's kind of a dating revolution. Mm-hmm. No one's going to tell you how to navigate it, right? It's one of these eras where you have to decide for yourself. Mm-hmm. And you have to create your own situation. And I think this is, for better or for worse, a time when people have to be really clear about things and really proactive about things. But that's also a wonderful opportunity, right? Not only for yourself, but also as a society to deal with some of these complex issues that we talked about today. So I'm optimistic. Despite some of the challenges, I'm very optimistic.